You sound excited to be here. We're excited that you're here, and we've been looking forward to this. We're excited that Tom Hamilton is here with us. He will be speaking to us just momentarily. When I step down, Jim Jonas is going to lead us in a word of prayer to our Creator, and then we'll turn it over to Tom. If you don't know Tom Hamilton, you're going to find out what others of us already know about him. He has a broad and deep knowledge of the Scripture. He has a clear, sharp mind, and he communicates the Word very clearly and very effectively. He's one of my favorite teachers to listen to. I appreciate him and glad he's here. I also commend to you his character. He's a fine man. He's got a lot of his family with him. A lot is elsewhere. He's got a very big family, and they're in the process of adoption soon. I haven't heard the details on how that's going, but very exciting family. Thrilled to have him here and all of those with him. We'll be here tonight. We'll be here tomorrow night on the question, isn't religion the major cause of all the world's problems? Saturday morning at 11 o'clock, isn't the God of the Bible evil, jealous, wrathful, vindictive, genocidal? And then our regular times on Sunday. The theme is, of course, answering objections to Christianity. Thank you very much for being here, and we'll now go to God in prayer.
Well, I'm afraid what we're going to find out in a few minutes is that Scott has a knack for stretching the truth. Every time I get up to speak, I always have a sense of kind of fear and trepidation. And then I get into the lesson, and I forget about myself, and I hope you will do the same, because we are here to think about God and to think about spiritual things, and the nature of the topic, answering objections to Christianity, is not the kind of lesson where we're going to be constantly looking at passages of Scripture, but I hope you will see that it is a spiritual topic and is something that the Bible talks about and gives us a number of perspectives from which to answer and understand these questions that arise. I can't tell you how much I've been looking forward to coming and being part of this Bible Forum. I was supposed to be here 2 years ago, and I apologize. I had to call up kind of at the last minute and cancel. We had been in Crimea trying to adopt two children, and the Russians showed up the day after we did. So I kind of joke Putin's following me around. And we came back to the States. We were still hopeful we would be able to bring those two children here and be part of our family, and that didn't work out, unfortunately. But all that was up in the air at the time. So I was really looking forward that when we could reschedule, I could come back with my family. And now my wife is not with me because she's in Washington State meeting a 12-year-old girl that we're going to adopt and make part of our family, and the timing was such that that was just when she had to go. So it's just one of those things. I was going to a fundraiser in Birmingham for Sacred Selections, and they'd asked me to speak and share our story, and I stopped for gas in Tifton, Georgia, and I only had half a tank, and it does take 5 minutes to fill your gas tank when it's only half full. The time I was out of the car and got back in, my wife says, "We're going to adopt another child." So I've taught the kids how to gas the car now. So we, but I do solicit your prayers about that. I sometimes feel like the crazy cat lady, don't know when to quit. But as long as we feel like we can give a child a home, we're going to do that. But we're here tonight to think about the objections that people make to Christianity. The first passage that immediately comes to my mind, of course, is 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 15. We talk about apologies, like apologizing to people that we can't be somewhere. And this word apology comes from a Greek word that sounds very much like our word apology, apologia, but it really doesn't mean an apology. You may be familiar with the study called apologetics or evidences, the idea of giving evidence for our faith or giving answers to objections to faith. And some prefer the term apologetics because it is derived from this passage in 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 15. And of course, what this text tells us is that we are to sanctify Christ as Lord in our hearts. And the reason he says it that way is because he's actually alluding back to Isaiah chapter 8, where Isaiah the prophet is told to sanctify the Lord God as holy. And in particular, in the context of Isaiah, Isaiah is facing a lot of persecution. People don't like the message that he's preaching. He is discouraged in a lot of ways. And Isaiah just needs to understand, the only thing you need to fear is the Lord. You don't fear what other people fear. You fear the Lord. And Peter is picking up on that same thing. We don't need to fear what the world fears. We just need to fear the Lord. And so the way he puts it here in 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 15 is that in sanctifying Christ as Lord in our hearts, we are always ready to make a defense to everyone who asks us to give an account for the hope that is in us, yet with gentleness and reverence. Or, as I put it here on the screen, to give an apologia for your hope. Now, I don't normally want to go around spouting Greek words in my lesson, but one reason I put it this way is because we need to understand that this answer or response is something in particular. It is, first of all, a verbal response, a verbal defense. You could read 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 15, the way I heard it growing up, which was, you have to be ready to give an answer to any idiotic question someone asks you about the Bible. How many angels can dance on the head of a pin? Well, you better be able to answer that question. That is not what Peter is saying. You might be new in the faith and not know a whole lot of the Bible. But if you are a follower of Jesus Christ, you have some reason, you have put your hope in him, and you should be able to tell people what that hope is. Particularly in the context where people who are asking the question are not asking an honest question. They're not really wanting to learn something. It's actually a challenge that they're issuing. And that's why the gentleness and reverence is called for in the way that we deal with people that are challenging us. And you can study that more in the context of 1 Peter chapter 3. But another way we can wrongly read 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 15 is that we just need to give an answer or some kind of response to whatever objections that are being made. And I have perfected the art of response. I did this in the second grade. Someone would say something, your mother wears army boots. Yours too! Now that's a response, right? I gave him an answer! Well, is that what Peter's saying? Say something! No, that's not what Peter means. You'll notice the word apologia has the word logic in it. To give a genuine verbal defense of the faith is to give a reasoned response, a logical, rational response. And it also has to be relevant to the issue at hand. You can't go off reasoning about some other issue. So it has to be reasoned. It has to be relevant. Now, obviously, some objections that people make are based upon emotion or tradition or any number of other motivating factors. But our answer must always be rational. There must always be a reason why. There must always be evidence for this. And so I start out with this as we begin this series of lessons, because this we need to be reminded of this for each of these lessons, that what we're trying to do is equip ourselves to do exactly what Peter says we ought to be doing here in 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 15. We need to be learning how to give a response to people who challenge us in a hostile world, in a hostile culture and society, people who challenge our faith, who say, well, what kind of moron believes something like that? Or, how dare you share your faith with me? I am, appalled that you think I'm so stupid that I would share your delusional worldview. How do you give a reasoned, relevant response to something like that? And so tonight we're going to consider the first of these objections that people raise against Christianity, that of exclusivity. And what we mean by that is the constant statement that you'll hear from many that Christians are narrow-minded. And no one wants to be thought of as being narrow-minded. Yet, I know the way a lot of Christians have tried to approach this is by saying, yes, I'm narrow-minded. How about that? I've set my mind on the narrow way or something like that. And that can be a kind of gimmicky or rhetorical response. But in fact, narrow-minded has a very specific definition to it. It is somebody who is unwilling to think, who is unwilling to consider evidence, who is unwilling to open his mind to consider the possibility that he might be wrong. And if there's anything the Bible teaches us, it is that a child of God is called to be open-minded. I mean, this is that noble-mindedness that the Berean Jews were commended for in Acts chapter 17. There is God's divine statement about whether we ought to be open-minded or not. I mean, you think about those poor Jews in Berea. They weren't Christians. They were just Jews worshiping in the synagogue in Berea. Paul shows up, and he starts teaching them something they've never heard. Now, what are their options? They could say, I've never heard this before. This can't be right. I'm not going to listen to this. Or they could have said, oh, wow, I've never heard this before. Let's just accept it, no matter what he's saying. But neither one of those options is what is commended in Acts chapter 17. In fact, when you look at the other two places Paul traveled on the different sides of Berea when he was there in Thessalonica, the attitude of many in the synagogue there was, I've not heard this before, this is wrong, I'm not going to listen to it. And they decide to persecute Paul. When he gets to Athens, they're eager to hear something new, something bizarre, something interesting. Well, the Bereans, they searched the scriptures daily to see whether the things Paul was teaching were true. Now, we're not told what the outcome was for every single Berean Jew there. Were there some open-minded people who still didn't get it? Were there those who were still searching and just couldn't see what the others were seeing? I'm not in a position to know, but I do know that the Holy Spirit commended the attitude of open-mindedness. And the thing we need to keep in mind is that open-mindedness was not based upon the fact that Paul was teaching the truth. Because they didn't know that until they searched the scriptures to see whether what Paul was saying was true. You understand? If before Paul got there, Frank the Butcher showed up, and he was teaching something they hadn't heard before, would they have just accepted that? No, they would have searched the scriptures daily, and they would have said, well, Frank, I'm sorry, that's just not in the Bible. But they searched the scriptures, and they find out, at least many of them did, this man Paul, he's teaching us the truth about what God was planning to do all of those years. And so that is the attitude that we need to have. We are to be open-minded. We are to think. We are to consider the possibility we might be wrong. Doesn't mean we're wrong, but we're willing to hear the evidence. We're willing to hear a different point of view. And so we don't want to be thought of as being narrow-minded, but we certainly don't want to make the mistake of confusing taking a narrow view with being narrow-minded. Those are two different things. And so as we will see as the lesson progresses, Christianity is a very narrow view, but in taking a narrow view, we're not being narrow-minded. And so how does that work? Well, this accusation of being narrow-minded works, you can find quotes all over the place that people will say. It's arrogant to say your religion is superior and to try to convert everyone else to it. Surely all the religions are equally good and valid for meeting the needs of their particular followers. And that sounds like it comes from somebody who themselves don't have a particular need for religion, but hey, it helps some people, that's fine. Or religious exclusivity is not just narrow, it's dangerous. Religion has led to untold strife, division, and conflict. It may be the greatest enemy of peace in the world. If Christians continue to insist that they have the truth, and if other religions do this as well, the world will never know peace. And you can just, again, multiply that time and time again. Well, what is it with this accusation that Christians are narrow-minded, that to say you have the truth is just arrogant and therefore wrong? How does one respond to such an accusation? Well, you need to realize, first of all, this is probably the most common objection that is raised against Christianity that you're going to run into. That's certainly the evidence that a lot of people have. That is their experience. We live in a pluralistic society where anything goes. Everybody's viewpoint is just as legitimate as somebody else's viewpoint. And in that kind of environment, then saying there is such a thing as truth itself is wrong, or truth with a capital T, anything that is absolute, anything that is objective truth. And so when we live in a culture that has so thoroughly been steeped with this mentality and bought into this notion that it's arrogant, it's narrow-minded, then why in the world would anybody in their right mind believe this? Why would any Christian believe something that is so not just unpopular, not just the minority viewpoint, but it is absolutely vilified everywhere you turn? The media, whether it's movies, whether it's songs, whether it's television, whether it's Facebook and so on, it's constantly vilified. This is a prime example of exactly what the Bible says. It speaks of a time when people will call that which is good evil and call that which is evil good. You're the bad guy. You're evil for saying what you say about Jesus being the only way that anybody can get to God. You ever stop and think about how narrow-minded that is? There are people all over planet Earth worshiping some 5,000 different gods. But don't worry, yours is the right God. What do you say to something like that? Well, you're right. You know, what are the odds? But hey, somebody's God had to turn out to be the right one. You know, it's kind of like playing the lottery. You don't win if you don't play. You know, just like you don't lose if you don't play either, you know. But so is that simply it, that we just happen to put our money on the right God? Well, that doesn't seem right. And so none of these arguments are rational, but they get a lot of traction with people. And just hurling names and calling people narrow-minded is enough in a lot of quarters to make the argument stick. So how does one, again, respond to that? Well, of course, the first answer I would say as to why someone would be so out of their mind to believe something as absurd as the fact that Jesus is the only way to get to God is the Bible teaches that. Now, you might say, well, that's something of a no-brainer, perhaps, but actually, if you will go to a lot of seminaries for mainline Protestant denominations, you do a lot of religious reading, different commentators and so on, you will find there's a rather widespread movement among so-called Christians who buy right into this notion that it is arrogant and narrow-minded to say that Jesus is the only way to get to God. Matthew chapter 7 in the Sermon on the Mount is a good reminder. Matthew chapter 7, verses 13 and 14, enter through the narrow gate, for the gate is wide and the way is broad that leads to destruction, and there are many who enter through it, for the gate is small and the way is narrow that leads to life, and there are few who find it. And so there are these two gates, two choices, and the one gate is narrow, the other gate is wide. There are a lot of people that find a way through the wide gate. There are very few people that find their way through the narrow gate. There again, you could be narrow-minded and setting your mind on that narrow gate. But as you finish out the Sermon on the Mount, you see this same two-choice option is given to you. There are two fruits. There are two destinies. There are two foundations that one can build upon. So time and again, we find this kind of thing taught in the New Testament. You just turn over to chapter 12 of Matthew, and you find out in verse 30, Jesus saying, "He who is not with me is against me, and he who does not gather with me scatters." You're either with Jesus or you're against Jesus. You're either gathering on behalf of him or scattering. There's no possibility of being neutral. You're either on the side of Jesus or not. John would put it this way: Jesus is the light that coming into the world shines on every man. There is not a human being on the planet that can escape the light of Jesus. That doesn't mean that everyone becomes enlightened. That doesn't mean everyone comes to the light. There are those who do come to the light, and there are those who love the darkness and like cockroaches scurry for it. But the claims of Christianity are so exclusive that even if you try to be neutral or indifferent is to take your side with the enemy. To fail to follow is to oppose Jesus. And so these exclusive claims begin to pile up the more you go through the Bible. In Acts chapter 4 and verse 12, we find out there is salvation under no other name but the name of Jesus. We find John the Apostle writing in 1 John chapter 2 and verse 23 that the one who denies the Son does not have the Father. And of course, the classic text that probably summarizes it more than anything else is John chapter 14 and verse 6. And these are the very words of Jesus that John has recorded. John chapter 14 and verse 6, "I am the way and the truth and the life." Well, that's fine. But if you've been studying the Gospel of John carefully up to this point, you already know good and well what John means by that. He is the only way. He is the only truth. He is the only source of eternal life. No one comes to the Father but through me. And that probably states it as clearly and succinctly as you can. And that's why some years ago the Southern Baptist Convention had a great brouhaha, a great debate among their membership. Do we espouse this teaching in John chapter 14 and verse 6, or do we try to ameliorate that somehow to make it more palatable or presentable to the world at large? Do we want to be thought of as an exclusivistic denomination or more inclusive? Because that's the N-word these days. Well, the problem is, if you want to be called a Christian by anything that is remotely defined that way in the New Testament, it is this: there is no way to the Father but through Jesus. Now, that sounds like the height of arrogance. But our problem is we have been taught to read the gospel stories as if they're simply stories about a good man helping little old ladies across the Sea of Galilee. You know, he was just a good person. And, you know, you kind of wonder, what in the world did he do to get himself killed? And it's not really his teaching that people objected to, unless it was something as blunt and direct as this. It was he himself they object to. The very person of Jesus, who he claimed to be. You know, when he was telling people to, you know, not be hypocrites, and they should obey God, and they should treat one another with compassion. Oh, well, yeah, that sounds great. I don't have any problem with that Jesus. But this Jesus, and of course the scholars would say, well, Jesus never said this. John, he didn't even write it. Some later disciple wrote this down and represented Jesus to make these claims for himself. But that doesn't work, because as you study the Gospels, it isn't just direct statements once in a while that someone has kind of inserted into the text, like in John 14 and verse 6, but it is constant throughout the life of Jesus. He is always doing things that for anybody else to do them, they would be nothing but sheer arrogance. You know the most offensive thing Jesus did while he walked upon the earth? He went around forgiving people. Now that doesn't sound very offensive. You know, that sounds like a good thing to do. But do you think how offensive it is to forgive other people when it's none of your business? Let's say someone breaks into your home and brutalizes you and your whole family and just kills them all. And I just come up a complete stranger, and I say to the person who perpetrated the crime, in the presence of you as a victim, and I say, you're forgiven. And you'd be like, what business is that of yours? What gives you the right to pronounce this person forgiven for what he did to me? Now, all the reason Jesus could do that is because the sin was against him, because he is God. He goes around acting like he's God. He goes around talking like he's God, because he is God. And so either Jesus is a hypocrite, that's to state it lightly, either he is the biggest fraud that has ever walked the face of the planet, or he was who he claimed to be, God. And he was vindicated by virtue of his resurrection from the dead. That proved that he was who he claimed to be. And so, when Jesus says, I am the only way to the Father, your choice is to say either that's a complete lie, and this Jesus who's constantly been talking that way all throughout the gospel story isn't even worth my time a day. I shouldn't even pay any lip service to following any religion that wears his name. Or he is who he claimed to be. There is no middle ground. There is no neutral position on this. And I'm going to have to take sides. Either Jesus was who he claimed to be or he was a liar. And so what will it be? And that's the question, that's the challenge we're presented with. But tonight, the challenge is simply to recognize that's the claim of Christianity. And anyone that comes along and says Christianity believes something other than that is believing something that's not Christian, believes in a Jesus that's not the Jesus of the Bible. You can have a religion, you can have a church, you can call it whatever you want, but it's not Christianity. It's not this teaching about this Jesus that the New Testament is talking about, and that's what we need to understand. So, I'm sorry to say, we as Christians are stuck with this idea that Jesus is the only way to the Father. Now, I don't think that's something to frown about. I don't think that's something we need to apologize for in the ordinary sense of the word. But we do need to be ready to give an answer to people, ask a reason for us. What makes us think that this Jesus is the only way to the Father? Well, one of the things we can point out to people is that this is simply the nature of any faith claim that anybody makes. And this is probably one of the misfortunes of using the word religion the way that we do. I think it is unfortunate that our Constitution talks about the freedom of religion. Because the moment people use the word religion, they think of something, religious, right? It has to do with churches or some other kind of religious organization. Has something to do with God, something to do with the supernatural. But you know, as you begin exploring that, that really doesn't fit. Buddhism is thought by everybody to be a religion, but it doesn't really believe in a personal God that most people would think of when they talk about God. If you think in terms of the supernatural, Hinduism doesn't believe in the supernatural that is beyond the material world. They simply talk about a spiritual quality that is in the material world. And yet we would still look at that as a religion. An atheist wouldn't have much use for it. And so as long as we're talking about religion and we can put that over there in the God container and say, well, that's just that stuff I've got no interest in, then we can continue to vilify religion and escape what is the real question. And the real question is not what is religion or non-religion. The question is, what faith claim do you live by? Because everybody does. And one of the things we have to get people to understand is, whether you are religious or not, whether you believe in God or not, as you would normally understand those terms, you make a claim about the nature of reality. And that claim is a claim of faith. And that's inescapable. Everybody makes a faith claim. Now, it may be that we spend a lot of our time just vegetating in front of a television, or we're drunk all of the time, and we don't really think about those things very clearly. But no human being can escape framing in their own mind and understanding some basic concept of what this world is really about. And really, I think we ought to understand religion, or a worldview, or a faith claim, whatever you want to call it, boils down to two simple questions. The first question of which is, what is the meaning of life? Why are we here? However you want to ask that question, it's getting at the purpose of our existence. What do you think this world is about? What do you think the nature of reality is? And you need to answer that question in some way. And the more consciously we think about it, the more evidence we have for the answer we give to that question, I think the better. And the second question is very simple. Based upon how you answer the first question, what should you do about it? And so, for example, somebody may conclude, there is no purpose to life. This is all a big cosmic accident. We're just here because some bacteria wrote on some back of some crystals and formed together into some amino acids and so on and so forth. And after billions of years and so on, here we are. There is no purpose. There is no meaning. There's no such thing as intelligence. There's no such thing as morality. There's nothing but biochemical processes firing away, giving the illusion of order and design and intelligence and morality, but it's really just a bunch of nothing but matter doing its thing. And so, question number two, what do you do about it? It really doesn't matter. Now, fortunately, most people don't live that way. They don't say, well, it's okay to abuse little children. It's okay to kill, you know, babies. Well, yeah, I guess we do that. On and on. It just doesn't matter. Well, but people do have morals. They do come up with rules, things they're willing to do. You know, you should like mama, not, you know, hate mama, things like that. Well, some people answer that question, there's a creator to whom we are accountable. And he created us to be in a relationship with him. And we have sinned and broken that relationship. And yet he's made it possible we can be restored to that relationship. What are you going to do about that? But that faith claim is one among many that are made by people. And so you have a Muslim and a Jew, and a Buddhist, and a Hindu, and a Sikh, and many other people, they answer those questions differently. But everybody answers that question, what is life about? What is the nature of reality? And they have a recommended course of action about what to do about that. Now, what we need to realize is, there is no escaping this. There is no neutrality. There's no Switzerland to which we can go where we say, I'm not answering the question. I will not consider the question. Because even that itself is a response. We're saying, here's what I'm going to do about it. I'm going to do nothing. Because that's the nature of my reality. You see, it is so wired within us, we cannot escape it. And I think what is really unfortunate about the political situation in which we live today is that we have gotten to the point with this idea of separation of church and state and so on, the idea that all viewpoints must be neutral. But there is no such thing. Now, we may believe in a society that is tolerant, that anybody can believe anything they want, and we're not going to imprison you for that belief, or we're not going to do this or that, you know, drag you out in the street and beat you to death because of that. But we do exalt certain points of view over others. For example, we think democracy in this country is a better, preferable way to govern people. But that's a point of view. That is predicated on a worldview that is shared, and we do not agree that all other worldviews about that government are equal. And it's pretty clear the Founding Fathers had a certain point of view that they acted upon, and it's just obvious, logical when you think about it. If you really say all points of view are absolutely equal, you would have nothing but paralysis. Societies could not even exist, really. And so we may claim that we're being neutral about things, but the reality is we can't escape that. And that's because ultimately, logic is what demands this exclusivity that takes place. Truth excludes the opposite of truth. There's something called the law of non-contradiction. Something can't be both X and not X at the same time and in the same sense. You know, that is, if you're using your words the same way and same time and place and circumstances, something can't be both what it is and what it isn't at the same time. It just doesn't work that way. So this is either the month of May, as we ordinarily use that word and so on, or it's not. You know, 2 + 2 = 4, or it is not. We are either currently sitting inside this auditorium or we are not, you know. And that's pretty much the reality of life as we experience it. And it's only when we come to something like philosophy or talk about morality or religion where suddenly it seems like the ordinary rules by which we operate daily just go out the window. And now we can suddenly entertain the notion that no longer does 2 plus 2 equal 4 when it comes to philosophy. We've got this group here that comes up with 5, and this group here that comes up with 6, and here's another group that comes up with 6. We got 5,000 different people adding up 2 plus 2 and coming up with something different for all of them. And isn't it wonderful, such plurality? Isn't it wonderful that everybody has a different number that they come up with when they add 2 and 2? Why is it only in the area of religion and morality and philosophy do people think that this kind of relativism can work? Well, I have a suspicion why that is the case. Let's suppose I came up with the notion, human beings do not need oxygen to live. Now, you may think that's a rather absurd and ridiculous claim to make, but I will prove it to you. I'll take a breath and see, I'm not breathing anymore. I don't need oxygen. I'm just proving that. Well, you would say, you idiot. Or maybe some of you would be kind enough not to say that. You'd say something more like, well, Tom, you still have oxygen in your lungs. Just because you're not breathing anymore doesn't mean you're still not using oxygen that you've stored up. And once that oxygen is depleted, you're going to pass out. And that's, I think, where our society is. Philosophically, we have filled our lungs with oxygen, enough philosophy, enough common sense, that we'll be able to hold our breath for a while, and we'll be able to get along in what oxygen stored up in our lungs, but there will come a time where that oxygen will be exhausted, and our society will collapse in a faint, if not die altogether. Or if you like old westerns, you know, where the equivalent of the car chase scene, you know, is the stagecoach, and it comes loose from the horses, and the thing's careening along, and it crashes into something, and the wheel goes rolling along, and that's simply the inertia that's been built up in that stagecoach. And now the stagecoach is no longer moving. It's been stopped, but the wheel keeps going. What makes that wheel keep rolling? Well, it's all that momentum that was built up when the horses were pulling the stagecoach. And so here is philosophy and common sense and clear thinking that's been driving mankind for thousands of years. And a lot of that's now been completely thrown out the window, and we seem to be getting along okay. So all these ridiculous claims, these absurd statements like people don't need oxygen, or at least that's their equivalent philosophically, they don't seem to be hurting us any at all. I don't see any ill effects. Well, we're starting to see the ill effects of that, aren't we? You know, the question of Dr. Phil is, how's that working for you? You know, how is the family doing? How are marriages in this country? How are homes thriving in this country, and so on? And so we're getting to the point where we've completely repudiated the philosophical foundation upon which our culture is built, but we're still living on the capital that was stored up by our ancestors, but eventually that's going to run out, and we're going to pay the consequences for repudiating this philosophy. But let me tell you, I am hopeful, because postmodern philosophical relativism, which I know is a mouthful, but that's just a fancy way of saying all of this idiocy, is so intellectually and logically bankrupt that I am pretty confident society cannot consist on this very long. Something is going to happen before too long to expose the bankruptcy of this. Now, I don't know how long it will take, and certainly I tend to be more impatient about these things. The day with the Lord is like 1,000 years, and 1,000 years like a day, so it may not be in my lifetime, it may not be in the lifetime of my kids or my grandkids, but I am certain that eventually this will collapse and something will have to take its place. So, some reasonably intelligent people down through the years have been saying some rather silly things, apparently without embarrassment. Oh, David Hume, back in the 1700s, If we take in our hand any volume of divinity or school metaphysics, for instance, now he's talking kind of fancy because he lived back in those old days, right? But he says basically, if you pick up any book that's on philosophy, let us ask, does it contain any abstract reasoning concerning quantity or number? Does it have to deal with hard science, things you can count, and mathematics? No. Second question, does it contain any experimental reasoning concerning matter of fact and existence? No. So having asked these two questions, and the answer is no, what do you do with this book in your hand? Commit it then to the flames, for it can contain nothing but sophistry and illusion. That sounds pretty impressive. I mean, he was a smart guy. And then you realize that you're reading this in a book that he's written that is not about quantity or number. It's not about matter of fact or existence. It is a philosophical statement that he himself ought to be thrown into the fire and burned. I'm in favor of following his advice in this case. Now, more recently, John Hicks has said, any exclusive claims to a superior knowledge of spiritual reality cannot be true. Well, that claim he just made was an exclusive claim to a superior knowledge about spiritual reality. And by his own admission, it cannot be true. Can people this intelligent really be that stupid? And the answer is yes. I don't know if this is a good example or not, because I don't know how bright he is. But you know, there was a rather famous movie that came out a few years ago called Star Wars. And there's this famous scene in which Obi-Wan is meeting with Anakin as he's turning into Darth Vader. And Anakin, Darth Vader says something like this to Obi-Wan. He says, you're either with me or you're against me. And what did Obi-Wan say? Only the Sith speak in absolutes. And I was sitting in the movie theater. First time I heard that, I thought, that's a pretty absolute statement Obi-Wan just made. I didn't know he was a Sith Lord. This is really taking a turn here. How does a person write a line in a movie like that that is so obviously self-contradictory and not even realize it, apparently? That's how ideologically committed people can be that not even reason or logic can dissuade them. But that doesn't mean that we don't still try to reason and give a reasoned and relevant response to them. And so what options do we have then in dealing with religion if we are in favor of pluralism? Well, we could try to outlaw religion, and then people have tried that in the past, and that's one of the great ironies. Religion is intolerant, causes violence. What do we do? Let's not tolerate it, and let's, you know, wipe it out. And of course, the other ironic thing is, the more you try to suppress religion, the more it seems to strengthen it. So a lot of atheists say they would love for religion to be outlawed, but they just don't recommend it because it's not a very workable solution. So fortunately, they don't consider it a viable option, but that's one way you could try to deal with it. I think the way our culture is trying to deal with it today is privatizing religion. You know, you think about this. They don't really care if we want to roar about God and just, you know, parade our wildlife all over the place as long as we stay in our cage. You know, if they want to go to the zoo and look at the lions, they'll come to church. They know where our zoo's located and watch us perform in our natural habitat. But don't let these lions run loose in the neighborhood, right? They don't want us bothering people. So you just keep your views to yourself. Well, do they have to keep their views to themselves? Well, no, because their views are neutral, right? No, their faith claims are faith claims too. But why are theirs better than ours? Doesn't that sound arrogant? Doesn't that sound exclusive? Well, no, we won't talk about that. And finally, we can caricature religion, and this is what is typically done. And the more we can ridicule religion, we can drive it into the private sphere and drive it out of the public sphere in embarrassment. And so three caricatures I want to talk about very quickly, because our time is running out, that all religions are equally valid, that each religion has only part of the truth, not all of, no religion has all of the truth, And all religion is culturally conditioned. You only believe what you believe because your mom and dad taught you that, or you were born in the United States rather than in Iran, you know, something like that. Well, let's consider this, these objections, really caricatures. All religions teach the same thing. Well, first of all, that's just patently false. When you look at religions, they do not teach the same thing. We've already noted that what Buddhists teach about God is not the same thing that Christians teach about God. And Hinduism doesn't teach the same things about the reality of the spiritual realm. Islam certainly doesn't believe in having a personal relationship with God, and that the problem is sin that needs to be atoned for, and things like that. Well, of course, what the objector would say, who is not an adherent to any of these religions, is that, well, those are just minor things. Those are just doctrinal issues that really don't matter. In all the big things, all religions are the same. Well, the question, of course, is who appointed you to determine what is doctrinally significant and what isn't. But it's also logically flawed because, again, just like only the Sith speak in absolutes, here is a person who comes along and says, you know, you have this exclusivistic, superior view about religion that I don't like, and it's wrong. And on what basis do I say that? Well, because I hold an exclusivistic and superior view about religion. Now, their view is not religiously motivated, but that doesn't change the fact it is superior. It is a truth claim. And so, once again, they're making a statement about reality, but it is self-contradictory. To say there's no such thing as truth itself is a statement of truth. It is a claim about truth. And is it true or not? And so, basically, people ought to be saying things like, there is no such thing as truth other than this one truth. You know, that, all points of view are equal and are not significant, except my view, which I've just shared with you. That's kind of like going around telling people, you shouldn't tell people that they're wrong. You're wrong for doing that. You know, again, it's self-contradictory, and that's the problem. And so, no, all religions don't teach the same thing. And again, if we expand that idea of religion to be faith claims, all faith claims are equal, your faith claim that all faith claims are equal, well, I don't agree with that. You know, and you don't believe it either. So it becomes very difficult to sustain. Of course, the interesting one is the old parable of the elephant. You know, you got these nine blind guys feeling of this elephant. The one guy says, oh, this is like a snake, and this is like a rope, and this is like a tree, and this is like a wall. And on it goes. And it makes for a very imposing kind of argument. I can't tell you how many people have been really impressed with this elephant being, you know, handled by these blind guys. And it's just, oh wow, it's so true. You know, here we are kind of groping about in the world, and we think we've got a handle on the truth, but it turns out it's just a part of the truth. Isn't that something? Boy, that's amazing. Yeah, each religion only has a part of the truth. Well, again, this is logically self-contradictory. And so a person's trying to disprove that there's only one right view. But how does he go about doing that, but that he has one right view? What is that right view in this case? There is an elephant. Well, how do you know it's an elephant? Well, see, in the story, there's a guy who can see, and he knows it's an elephant. And it's these other blind guys who don't know it's an elephant, but there is such a thing as objective truth. There really is an elephant. And it really has all these different parts to it. And he can see it. And so there is one point of view that is true and that is right, after all. And there is somebody in the story who does have the whole truth about the elephant. And so it becomes self-contradictory to try to use that to prove that nobody knows the whole truth about the elephant. Now, if it proves anything, it's that, hey, there is somebody who does know the truth about the elephant. You got to find that guy. Don't listen to that blind guy who's only got part of the truth. Find that guy who knows about the elephant, right? You know, here's a guy who proves that all religions are right by essentially proving that they're all wrong. You know, with the guy who's saying this elephant's like a rope, no, it's not. It's not like a tree. It's not like a wall. It's not like a snake. It's not like any of those things. It's an elephant. It's like an elephant. And until you know it's like an elephant, you don't really know anything. Even the part you know doesn't mean anything. And so again, it presumes there is an objective truth to prove that there is no such thing as objective truth. And of course, it presumes we're all blind. Now, there's a sense in which you could say, yeah, we don't have the kind of sight that we would like to have spiritually. But are we that blind? Are we that groping around that we don't really have a clue what we're looking at? Well, I think the Bible gives us a little bit of light and guidance on that. And then finally, religion is culturally conditioned. It's saying all moral and spiritual claims are the product of a particular historical and cultural moment. And therefore, no one should claim that they can know the truth, since no one can judge whether one assertion about spiritual and moral reality is truer than another. And again, you know exactly the same problem with this statement. It's just as self-contradictory as the other. If we were to summarize it, simplify it, all claims about religion are historical and cultural conditioned, except this one. I somehow have escaped cultural conditioning. I somehow am not the product of my upbringing. So that my statement about religions all being equal or all being culturally conditioned, you should listen to me. And so the person says, well, Tom, you were born in Arkansas in the 20th century. That's why you believe what you believe. If you had been born in Iran, you would have been a good Muslim. And I would have said, Mr. Secularist, because you were born in New York City in the 21st century, you are a secularist. And you believe in your secular culture. And imposing your ethnocentric cultural worldview on other people. And had you been born in Iran, maybe you would have been a bad Muslim. I don't know. But no, he doesn't entertain the notion that he's a product of his cultural conditioning. It's other people. Well, again, that's the ultimate problem. Yes, bias is real. And that's the problem with a lot of these arguments that are made. There's a kernel of truth to all of it. And that's why it can be something that easily deceives us. But what we simply do is recognize, yeah, we're culturally biased, but are we capable of rising above that? Are we capable of recognizing it and still being open-minded and still willing to weigh evidence and consider an alternate point of view? And I have certainly known many Christians who think quite differently than they did from how they were raised. People that were Muslims who have been converted to Christianity, people who have been Jews converted to Christianity, and so on. We are capable of thinking differently and being compelled by the evidence of the Gospels, because Jesus is what makes the difference, that Jesus was raised from the dead, that Jesus was who he claimed to be, that Jesus himself is God, and he has given of himself to atone for our sin. So I believe now we're going to take a break and leave that to Scott. Thank you. I have sorted through the questions. I appreciate very much. That's one of the things I don't like about preaching, is it's typically done so one-sided. So it's good to have an opportunity where you can have some immediate feedback and address some things. And of course, I didn't think what I had to say would take as long as it did. And I apologize. You've been so patient and kind. But a couple of these questions that were presented give an opportunity to consider something I think that is very important. And that is, you know, what tactics, say, one would use in actually responding to a person that may be challenging our faith, or just genuinely even asking an honest question about a difference of their point of view. And of course, what I've been trying to do this evening is not to say this is the way one should actually talk to people who hold a different point of view, as much as to explore and understand what lies behind the unstated assumptions that people make. Because I have found that most people don't really think very clearly or thoroughly about what they believe and why they believe it. I think that's really why the two taboo topics in polite society are politics and religion. And why is that? And I've concluded it's because they're the two areas of life in which we make the most personal of decisions, really personal choices, but most people don't really have very good reasons for why they made the choice they did. And they know that deep down inside. And so when someone asks them a question, it comes across as a challenge. Why are you voting for that bozo? You know, why do you believe that idiotic doctrine? But you can imagine, if you're a devoted Christian and you love God and the Word of God, and someone asks you, you're eager. What? Great, you've given me a chance to answer. Let me explain to you why I believe this. And you don't think it is a challenge at all. It's an opportunity. And if we were more confident of why we make the political and religious choices that we do, we might view these more as opportunities rather than as challenges. But for most people, they are challenges because they don't really know why they do what they do and they haven't thought through it. And often, a person will ask a question, and that's not really the question they're asking. There's a question behind the question. There's the unstated assumptions that are behind the question. And Jesus is the master at this. You notice how rarely Jesus ever answers anybody's question? Because he's always answering the real question, not the one they asked, right? And so I do think that when we are in a situation, we have to be sensitive to the fact that we're dealing with another person who's made in the image of God, and a person that if we have a different worldview from, we clearly think they're wrong because we think we're right. Nobody thinks they're wrong and continues believing what they think is wrong. We all think we're right. But we think we're right about something that's so important that we want to share that with them, and we want them to be right about it too. And we're sensitive about that, and we know that we can't coerce people. We can't force it down their throat. We can't strong-arm people. There's no point getting into a debate and trying to win it with some kind of getcha, you know, little soundbite kind of argument. It is to really care about people. And to, you know, of course, the better you know them, the better relationship you have with them, the better you're able to use that. And so, you know, one of the questions asked about that, it helps more if you act kindly. They don't care what you think, but it will impress upon them more if you just deflect the question, accusation, to give a kind, not debating response. Beating these people down with logic will not help. And I think that is true. We're sensitive to what their real need is and whatever we can do to really reach that and help them. And even if we can never get them to agree with us or whatever, we are still here to serve them. We're still here to love them. God loves them, and we are to love them. We're really going to talk some more about this tomorrow night. There's a lot of overlap, in a sense of speaking, because the topic tomorrow is religion really the cause of all the trouble in the world, is closely related to this question about you know, the claim of Christianity being so exclusive. And that's what makes it so dangerous and so prone to causing violence in the world. And that kind of thing. Another question was, why not ask the unbeliever by what moral standard he presupposes to judge the believer as narrow-minded or arrogant? And again, I think it's helpful to put the task of thinking on them. Well, why do they believe what they believe? By what standard are they evaluating what is right and what is wrong? Try to get them to see that everybody has a faith claim. Everybody has some concept of reality and what we ought to do about it. And if you can get people to realize, yeah, that's true, then what makes one faith claim better than another? What is the evidence? And if we could get in a constructive conversation about the evidence, surely we're not just left throwing darts at a dartboard randomly to pick what we think reality is about and what we ought to do about it. Another question. How do we teach people to use the Bible to evaluate society instead of using society to evaluate the Bible? Well, if I knew the absolute guaranteed answer to that question, I'd bottle it and be a millionaire. That is a great challenge. There is the constant danger of wanting to read the Bible through our own rose-colored glasses. We are socially conditioned people. I am influenced by the way my parents raised me. Those things are realities that we have to deal with. The best I can suggest is we just need to recognize those things and bend over backwards as best as we can to see whether we really are looking for the truth and following the evidence, or we've already got our mind made up and we're just looking for rationalization and justification for that. And the more we're influenced by culture and society, we need to be aware of those influences. It's not just mom and dad that raised me. It was also Captain Kangaroo and, you know, Sergeant Joe Friday and, you know, Gilligan and a lot of other people, sad to say. sometimes in very subtle and insidious ways. So, we would be fools to realize, if we did not realize, that American society is over-sexualized and extremely materialistic. And if you think you as a Christian are going to live in this world and somehow those noxious fumes are not going to creep in through the crevices of your life and infect your thinking and influence you, then you're just ready-made for a fall. We need to realize this is the predominant society and culture that bombards us constantly, and it has probably affected our thinking about human sexuality and money and possessions. And I certainly think you can see a lot of evidence for that, even in the lives of many Christians that are struggling and suffering in this world. So it's a constant problem, a constant threat. And the Bible is God's corrective. It is his objective standard to say, look here for the answer. And a lot of times the Bible takes us back to the beginning. You know, how did God design things in the beginning, before there was any culture to begin with? What is God's plan? What is God's way? What is God's will? Not my will, not the will of society, but what does God want? And again, I want to be fair. It is very easy for people to read the Bible and impose their own assumptions on it. And if that's what you want to do, there's nothing to stop you. You know, God's not going to force you to read the truth. You can't, force people to drink the water of life any more than you can force that horse to drink the water that you've dragged him to. And so we put the truth out there, and people that want the truth will find the truth. I have to admit, there's a part of me that would like to get an AK-47 and go hold it to everybody's head and make them do what's right. You know, you think about elders who say, how can we get people to attend church more often? Now, you can get 100% church attendance if you go hold a gun to their head. You know, and there's this part of me that says, that works. That really works. But you know, it doesn't, because it doesn't change the part that really needs to be changed, which is the heart. Now, God, I am certain, can coerce everybody. He has the power to do it. And with something, you don't even need a gun. But God does not coerce anybody. God simply puts the truth out there. Does everybody want the truth? No. And that's why the truth doesn't work sometimes, so to speak. But for those who are looking for the truth, they will find it. And so our job is simply to put the truth out there. And those that are looking for it, I am convinced, will find that. And one final question. How do Christians need to respond to the allegation that by standing up for what is right and opposing radical Islam, that is to blame for the violent response of radical Muslim extremists? Well, that's an interesting question. I think there were radical Muslim extremists long before they probably heard of a lot of Christians standing up for Christianity. I think a lot of it's more politics than religion. And I'm not an expert on those things. I will tell you, there are two people I have known personally who were Muslims. They were certainly not radicalized Muslims. But I will tell you what they have told me about what convinced them of the truthfulness of Christianity. And you have to understand that to them, when they were growing up, Christianity was a certain form of Catholicism. All their friends were Catholic. And the way that they lived wasn't very pious. They saw religion as a joke. And so for them, they say, well, that's Christianity. I've got no interest in it. And again, I don't say that to demean, other Catholics. There are many fine, devout Catholic people out there. But I'm just telling you, the Catholics these young men knew were not that way. And they thought, if that's religion, if that's Christianity, my religion is far superior to that. And so once they were exposed to true New Testament Christianity, they began to realize what the Bible is about, who Jesus really is. And they found that a very convicting message about Jesus. And that just reminds us, it always comes back to Jesus. It's not about a religious dogma. It's not about an organization that we're trying to dupe people into joining. It is about Jesus. Jesus is God. Jesus is the one that we all need. And I think this idea of exclusivism would be easier for people to swallow if they understood really what the claim of Christianity is. you know, if you want to evaluate any religion or worldview or faith claim, you simply ask the question, what is the problem? Now, if my problem is I don't have a big enough TV, what is the answer? We need to design and build bigger TVs, right? If the need of the world is better plumbing, let's find better plumbing. The Bible says the need of man is sin. And that's the problem that needs to be addressed. And how do you address the problem of sin? Once you understand there's a gulf between God and man that's so wide, man cannot cross it. Only God can provide that bridge. What is that bridge? And the Bible claims that God himself is that bridge. And we know that bridge's name in the name of Jesus. And then it makes sense. No, Muhammad can't get us across that gulf. Buddha can't get us across that gulf. No amount of good works can get us across that gulf. Only God himself. And once you understand that's the problem and that's the solution, it becomes obvious. Only something like what we call Jesus could be the way to God. And there's nothing arrogant about that claim at all. It's just true that only God can solve our problem, and he did, and his name was Jesus. And that's what the Bible teaches us. And we'll talk some more about that again tomorrow, about what that message is. Again, you've been so kind, and I hope maybe we'll see you again tomorrow, and we'll talk some more about the problem of religion, whether it's causing all of the trouble in the world today.